The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 1, continued. Cassette 2, Side 1. After all, the Solovetsky Islands people did not yet, generally speaking, firmly believe that the ovens of the Arctic Auschwitz had been lit right there, and that its crematory furnaces had been thrown open to all who were ever brought there. But, after all, that is exactly how it was. People there were also misled by the fact that all their prison terms were exceedingly short. It was rare that anyone had a 10-year term, and even 5 was not found very often, and most of them were 3, just 3. And this whole cat-and-mouse trick of the law was still not understood, to pin down and let go, and pin down again and let go again. And that patriarchal failure to understand where everything was heading could not have failed entirely to influence the guards from among the prisoners also, and perhaps, in a minor way, the prison keepers themselves. No matter how clear-cut the declarations of the class teaching, openly displayed and proclaimed everywhere, that the sole fate the enemy deserves is annihilation, still it was impossible to picture to oneself the annihilation of each concrete two-legged individual possessing hair, eyes, a mouth, a neck, and shoulders. One could actually believe that classes were being destroyed, but the people who constituted these classes should be left, shouldn't they? The eyes of Russians who had been brought up in other generous and vague concepts, like eyes seeing through badly prescribed eyeglasses, could in no wise read with exactitude the phrases of the cruel teaching. Not long before, apparently, there had been months and years of openly proclaimed terror. Yet it was still impossible to believe. Here, too, on the first islands of the archipelago, was felt the instability of those checkered years of the middle 20s, when things were but poorly understood in the country as a whole. Was everything already prohibited? Or, on the contrary, were things only now beginning to be allowed? Age-old Russia still believed so strongly in rapturous phrases, and there were only a few prophets of gloom who had already figured things out and who knew when and how all this would be smashed into smithereens. The cupola had been damaged by fire, but the masonry was eternal. The land cultivated on the very edge of the earth had now been laid waste. The colour of the restless sea was changeable, the lakes still, the animals trusting, the people merciless. And the albatrosses flew to the Bay of Biscay to spend the winter with all the secrets of the first island of the archipelago. But they would not tell their secrets on the carefree beaches, but they would tell no one in Europe. A fantastic world. And one of the main short-lived fantasies was this. Camp life was run by white guards. So Kurilko was not a chance phenomenon. Here is how it worked. In the whole Kremlin, the only free Czechist was the camp duty officer. Guarding the gates, there were no watchtowers, and patrolling the islands and catching escapees were up to the guard. Other than free people, they recruited into the guard ordinary murderers, counterfeiters, and other habitual criminals, but not the thieves. But who was there to take charge of the whole internal organization? Who was to run the administrative section? And who were to be the company and squad commanders? Not, certainly, the priests, nor the sectarian prisoners, nor the NEP men, nor the scholars, nor the students. There were no few students there, too, but a student's cap on the head of a Solovetsky prisoner was considered a challenge, an impudence, a black mark, and an application to get shot. It was former military men who could do this best. And what military people were there, other than the white officers? And thus, without any special deal, and hardly as the result of any well-thought-out plan, the Solovetsky cooperation of the Czechists and the white guards began. Where were the principles of either? It is surprising, astonishing, only to someone used to social analysis on a class basis and unable to see differently. But to such an analyst, everything in the whole world is bound to be astonishing, because the world and human beings never fit into his previously set grooves. And the Solovetsky prison keepers would have taken the devil himself into their service, given that they had not been given red personnel. It had been decreed, The prisoners should supervise themselves, in other words, oppress themselves. And who was there to whom this could better have been entrusted? And as for the eternal officers, the military breed, how could they forego taking into their own hands at least the organization of camp life, camp oppression? Just how could they stand aside submissively, watching someone else take charge incapably and mess everything up? We have already discussed earlier in this book the subject of what shoulder boards do to the human heart. And just bide your time. The day will come when the Red commanding officers will be arrested too, and how they will fight for jobs in the camp guards, how they will long to get hold of a turnkey's rifle just so as to be trusted again. I have already said that if Malyuta Skuratov had just summoned us... Well, and the White Guards must have felt much the same. All right, we're lost anyway, and everything is lost, so what difference does it make? Why not? Then, too, the worse the better. We'll help you make a hellhole out of Solovki, of a kind that never ever existed in our Russia, and your reputation will be all the worse. And then, all the rest of our boys agreed, so what am I supposed to do? Sit in the warehouse as a bookkeeper, like a priest? Nonetheless, the most fantastic Solovetsky story was not just that alone, but the fact that, having taken over the administrative section, the White Guard began to put up a fight against the Chekists. It's your camp on the outside, so to say, and ours on the inside. And it was the business of the administrative section to decide who worked where and who would be sent where. We don't meddle outside, so don't you meddle inside. Not very likely, that. For after all, the Information and Investigation Section, the ISCH, had to have the whole inside of the camp speckled with its stoolies. This was the primary and the dreaded power in camp, the ISCH. And the security officers were also recruited from among the prisoners, the crowning glory of prisoner self-supervision. And that was what the White Guard Administrative Section, the ACH, took upon itself to do battle with. All the other sections, the cultural and educational section and the medical section, which would have such great significance in future camps, were both frail and pitiful here. And the economic section, headed by N. Frenkel, was also merely vegetating. It engaged in trade with the outside world and ran the non-existent industry. The paths of its future grandeur had not yet been plotted. So it was the two powers, the ISCH and the ACH, that fought it out. It began right at the Chem transit camp. The newly arrived poet A. Yaroslavsky approached the squad commander and whispered something in his ear. The squad commander bellowed out his words with military precision, "You were secret, so now you're public." The ISCH had its Sekerka, its punishment blocks, its denunciations, its personal case files on the prisoners, and had control of liberating prisoners ahead of time and executions. It also was in charge of censoring letters and parcels. And the ACH controlled work parties, reassignment from island to island, and prisoner transports. The ACH exposed the ISCH stoolies in order to send them off on prisoner transports. The stoolies were pursued and fled and hid in ISCH headquarters. But they were pursued even there, and the ISCH rooms were broken into and the stoolies dragged out and hauled off to prisoner transports. It is interesting that the dawn of the archipelago thus began with the very same phenomenon to which the later special camps returned, with a blow struck at the stoolies. They were dispatched to Kondrostrov, to logging camps. And there the fantastic story went right on. In Kondrostrov, the exposed and ruined stoolies published a war newspaper entitled Stukach Stooli. And in it, with sad humor, they further exposed in each other such sins as being over-pampered and the like. At this point, the heads of ISCH brought charges against the eager beavers of the ACH, lengthened their terms, and sent them to Sekirka. But the ISCH defense was complicated by the fact that an exposed informer, in the interpretation of those years, was considered a criminal. Article 121 of the Criminal Code, disclosure by an official personage of information not to be disclosed. Quite independently of whether disclosure took place intentionally or not, and in what degree the individual was actually an official personage. Consequently, exposed informers could not be defended and saved by the ISCH. Once caught, they had only themselves to blame. Kondostroff was almost legitimized. The height of the hostilities between the ISCH and the ACH came in 1927, when the White Guards broke into the ISCH, cracked the safe, seized and published the complete lists of stoolies, who thereby became hopeless criminals. After that, however, the ACH steadily declined. There were ever fewer former officers, and the percentage of criminals continually rose. For example, the Chubarovtsi, as a result of the notorious Leningrad thugs trial. And gradually the administrative section was subdued. Yes, and then in the 30s a new camp era began, when Solovki even ceased to be Solovki and became a mere run-of-the-mill corrective labor camp. And the black star of the ideologist of that new era, Naftali Frenkel, rose in the heavens while his formula became the supreme law of the archipelago. We have to squeeze everything out of a prisoner in the first 3 months. After that, we don't need him anymore. But where are Savati and German and Zosima? Who was it who thought of living below the Arctic Circle, where cattle can't be bred, and fish can't be caught, and bread grains and vegetables don't grow? Oh, you experts at ruining flourishing lands, so soon, in 1 year or two, to reduce the model agricultural enterprise of the monks to total and irreversible decline. How was it done? Did they plunder it and send away the plunder, or did they destroy it all right there on the spot? And to be incapable of extracting anything from the good earth while possessing thousands of unoccupied hands? Only the free people there had milk, sour cream, and fresh meat, yes, and the excellent cabbage of Father Methodius. And for prisoners there was rotten cod, salted or dried, a thin gruel with pearl barley or millet grits, and without potatoes. And there was never either cabbage soup or borscht. And as a result there was scurvy, and even the office workers' companies all had boils. And as for those on general work, their situation can be imagined. Prisoner transports returned on all fours from distant work parties. They actually crawled from the wharf on hands and knees. The prisoners were allowed to use up 9 rubles a month out of money orders from home, and there was a prison commissary in the chapel of German. And 1 parcel a month could be received, which was opened and inspected in the ISCH. And if you didn't bribe them, they would announce that much of what had been sent you was prohibited. Grits, for example. In the Nikolskaya Church and in the Uspensky Cathedral, the bunks rose 4 tiers high. Nor was the 13th Company any less crowded in the block attached to the Preobrazhensky Cathedral. Imagine the crowded mass of prisoners at that entrance. 3,500 stampeding back to quarters on returning from work. It took an hour's wait in line to get hot water at the boilers. On Saturdays, the evening roll calls dragged out till very, very late at night, like the former religious services. They were very particular about hygiene, of course. Prisoners were forced to have heads clipped and beards shaved off. Also, all priests, one after another. In addition, they cut all the flaps off long clothing, particularly cassocks, of course. But they were a principal point of infection. The Czechists had greatcoats which reached right down to the ground. True, in the winter the ill and the aged, sitting there in underwear and sacks, could not make it to the baths from their company bunks. They were done in by the lice. They hid the corpses under the bunks so as to get the extra rations, even though that was not very advantageous for the living. The lice crawled from the cold corpses onto the warm, living survivors. In the Kremlin there was a bad medical section with a bad hospital, and in the remoter parts of Solovki there was no medicine at all. The sole exception was the Golgotha Crucifixion Monastery on Anzer, a penalty work party where they cured patients by murdering them. There, in the Golgotha Church, prisoners lay dying from lack of food and from cruelty, enfeebled priests next to syphilitics, and aged invalids next to young thieves. at the request of the dying, and in order to ease his own problem, the Golgotha doctor gave terminal cases strychnine. And in the winter, the bearded corpses in their underwear were kept in the church for a long time. Then they were put in the vestibule, stacked standing up, since that way they took up less space. And when they carried them out, they gave them a shove and let them roll on down Golgotha Hill. This is an unusual name for a church and monastery, not encountered anywhere else. According to legend, a manuscript of the 18th century in the State Public Library, Solovetsky Patarik, The Lives of the Solovetsky Fathers, on June the 18th, 1712, the monk priest Job, during an all-night prayer vigil at the foot of this hill, saw a vision of the Mother of God in all the glory of heaven, and she said to him, "This hill from henceforth shall be called Golgotha, and on it shall be built a church and a monastery of the crucifixion, and it will be whitened by the sufferings of countless multitudes." That is what they named it, and they built it there, but for more than 200 years the prophecy was an empty one, and it did not seem likely that it would ever come true. But after the Solovetsky camp, one could no longer say this. At one time, in 1928, a typhus epidemic broke out in Chem, and 60% of those there died, but the typhus crossed to Bolshoi Solovetsky Island as well, and hundreds of typhus patients lay about in the unheated theatrical hall all at the same time. And hundreds likewise left there for the cemetery. So as not to confuse the count, the worker signers wrote the last name of every prisoner on his wrist, and some of those who recovered switched terms with shorter-term cadavers by rewriting the corpses' names on their own hands. And when many thousands of the Central Asian Basmachi rebels were herded here in 1929, they brought with them an epidemic characterized by black spots on the body, and all who fell ill with it died. It could not, of course, be the plague or smallpox, as Solovki people imagined it was, because those two diseases had already been totally wiped out in the Soviet Republic. And so they called the illness Asiatic typhus. They didn't know how to cure it, and here is how they got rid of it. If one prisoner in a cell caught it, they just locked the cell and let no one out, and passed them food only through the door, till they all died. What a scientific discovery it would be for us to establish that in Solovki the archipelago had not yet arrived at an understanding of itself, that the child had not yet guessed its own character. And then to observe how this character gradually manifested itself. Alas, it didn't work out that way. Even though there was no one to learn from, even though there was no one from whom to take an example, and even though it would seem that there was no hereditary element, nonetheless, the archipelago swiftly discovered and manifested its future character. So much future experience had already been discovered at Solovki. The phrase, to extricate from general work, had already come into existence. All slept on board bunks, but there were nevertheless some who had individual cots. There were whole companies in the church, but some prisoners were crowded 20 to a room, and there were other rooms with only 4 or 5. There were already some who knew their rights to inspect the women's prisoner transports and pick out a woman. There were only 150 to 200 women for thousands of men, but later on there were more. A struggle for the soft, cushy spots through boot-licking and betrayal was already going on. They had already removed all the kontriki, counter-revolutionaries, from office positions, to which they were then restored because the habitual criminals only messed everything up. The camp air was already thick with continual ominous rumours. The supreme law of conduct had already become trust no one, and this squeezed and froze out the spiritual grace of the Silver Age. The free persons, too, had begun to enter into the sweetness of camp life and to taste its joys. Free families received the right to have the free services of cooks from the camp. They could always demand the services of woodcutters, laundresses, seamstresses, and barbers. Eichmann's built himself an Arctic villa. Potemkin, too, a former sergeant major of the Dragoons, subsequently a communist, a Czechist, and then the chief of Chem Transit Camp, lived lavishly. He opened a restaurant in Chem. His orchestra was recruited from conservatory musicians. His waitresses wore silk dresses. Gulag comrades who arrived from Rash and Moscow could feast and frolic in luxury here at the beginning of the 30s. They were served at table by Princess Shakhovskaya, and their cheque was only a formality, amounting to something like 30 kopecks, the rest being at the camp's expense. Yes, and the Solovetsky Kremlin, this was not the whole Solovki. It was the most privileged place in camp. The real Solovki was not even in the monasteries, where, after the socialists were sent away, work parties were established. The real Solovki was in the logging operations at the remote work sites. But it is precisely those distant backwoods that are most difficult to learn about nowadays, because those people did not survive. It is known that even at that time they did not allow the workers to dry themselves out in the autumn, that in winter they did not provide them with clothes or footgear in the deep snow, and that the length of the workday was determined by the work norm. The workday was completed when the work norm had been executed, and if it wasn't, there was no return to shelter until it was. And at that time, too, they discovered the device of new work parties, which consisted of sending several hundred people to totally unprepared, uninhabited places. But it would seem that in the first years of Solovki, both slave-driving the workers and allotting back-breaking work norms took the form of periodic outbursts, transitory anger. They had not become a vice-like system. The economy of the whole country was not based on them, and the five-year plans had not been instituted. In the first years of SLON, there was evidently no firm external economic plan. Yes, and for that matter, there was no very careful calculation of how many man-days went into work for the camp as a whole. This was why they could suddenly switch with such frivolity from meaningful productive work to punishment, pouring water from one ice hole into another, dragging logs from one place to another and back. There was cruelty in this, yes, but there was also a patriarchal attitude. When slave driving became a thought-out system, pouring water over a prisoner in sub-zero temperatures, or putting the prisoner out on a stump to be devoured by mosquitoes, had turned into a superfluity and a useless expenditure of the executioner's energy. There is an official figure, up to 1929 in the RSFSR, the Russian Republic of the Soviet Union, only 34 to 41% of all prisoners were engaged in work. And how could it have been any different in view of the fact that there was unemployment in the country at the time? It is not clear whether work at servicing and maintaining the camp itself was included in this, or whether it was only external work. At any rate, work at servicing and maintaining the camp itself would not have been enough to occupy all the remaining 60 to 65% of the camp prisoners. This proportion found its expression at Solovki as well. Clearly, throughout the '20s, there were no few prisoners without permanent work, partly because of the lack of anything to wear outdoors, or else performing purely formal duties. That first year of the first five-year plan, which shook up the entire country, shook up Solovki as well. The new chief of SLON, appointed in 1930, Nogtev, the same chief of the Savatyevsky monastery who had shot down the socialists, reported, to the accompaniment of a whisper of astonishment in an astounded hall, to the free inhabitants of the city of Chem, these figures. Not counting its logging operations for its own use, which had grown at quite exceptional tempos, USLON had filled external orders alone for the Railroad Timber Trust and the Karelian Timber Trust in 1926, 63,000 rubles. In 1929, 2,355,000 rubles, 37 times greater. And in 1930, the total had jumped another three times. Road construction for the Karelian Murmansk region had been carried out in 1926 in the amount of 105,000 rubles, and in 1930, 6 million, increased by 57 times. And that is how the once remote Solovki, where they didn't know how to make full use of the prisoners, came to an end. The miracle worker work rushed in to assist. Solovki was created via Chem Transit Camp, and via Chem Transit Camp Solovki, in its maturity, began at the end of the '20s to spread back to the mainland. And the worst thing that could now befall a prisoner was to be sent out on these work parties on the mainland. Previously, the sole mainland points belonging to Solovki were Soroka and Sumsky Posad, coastal appurtenances of the monasteries. but now the advancing SLON forgot its monastery boundaries. From Kem, through the swamps to the west, to Uchta, the prisoners began to build a dirt road, which had at one time been considered almost impossible to build. In the summer, they drowned, and in the winter, they froze. The Solovki prisoners feared this road to the point of panic, and for a long time the threat echoed and re-echoed over the Kremlin courtyard. What? You're asking for Uchta? The second, similar road was from Medvezhegorsk to Palandovsky. On its route, the Chekist Gajidze ordered explosives set into a cliff, and then sent KRs up on the cliff and through his binoculars watched them being blown up. They say that in December 1928 on Krasnyagorka in Karelia, the prisoners were left to spend the night in the woods as punishment for failure to fulfill the assigned norm of work, and 150 men froze to death there. This was a standard Solovetsky trick. Hard to doubt the story. There is somewhat greater difficulty in believing another story, that in February 1929, on the Kem-Uchta road near the tiny settlement of Kut, a company consisting of approximately 100 prisoners was driven into the bonfire for failure to fulfill the work norm and burned alive. I was told this story by one solitary person only who had been close by, Professor D.P. Kalistov, an old Solovki veteran, who died recently. But I was never able to collect any corroborative testimony. And maybe no one ever will collect any, and there is also much else about which no one is ever going to collect testimony, even one single solitary report. But after all, why shouldn't people who freeze other people to death and who blow them up in an explosion burn them alive? Because the technology involved was no more complex. Let those who prefer to put their faith in the printed word rather than in living people read about the road building by this very same USLON and by the very same Zex in the very same year, except that the area was the Kola Peninsula. With great difficulty, we built the dirt road along the valley of the Belaya River, along the shore of Lake Budyarov to Kukizvumchor, near the present Apatiti, for a distance of 17 miles, paving a swamp. And what would you think it was paved with? The answer fairly leaps to the tip of the tongue, doesn't it? But it can't be set down on paper. With logs and sand embankments, levelling the capricious configuration of the crumbling slopes of the stony mountains. And then USLON built a railroad there in addition. 7 miles in a single winter month. And why in 1 month? And why couldn't it have been postponed till summer? The task seemed insuperable, 400,000 cubic yards of excavations. North of the Arctic Circle, in the middle of winter, and they called it Earth, it was harder than any granite. Performed solely by hand, with pick, crowbar, and spade. And did they at least have mittens? The work was delayed by the need for a multitude of bridges. Work went on for 24 hours a day in 3 shifts, and the Arctic night was sliced by the light of incandescent kerosene lanterns, as clearings were cut through the pine woods and stumps were dug out in the midst of snowstorms which covered the roadbed deeper than the height of a man. Now go back and read that over, then close your eyes and picture the scene. You are a helpless city dweller, a person who sighs and pines like a character in Chekhov. And there you are in that icy hell. Or you are a Turkmenian in your embroidered skullcap, your Tiubeteika, out there in the night blizzard, digging out stumps. This was in those best and brightest 20s, before any personality cult, when the white, yellow, black, and brown races of the earth looked upon our country as the torchbearer of freedom. Oh, Bertrand Russell, oh, Hewlett Johnson, where, oh, where was your flaming conscience at that time? This was during those self-same years when they used to sing amusing ditties about Solovki from the nation's vaudeville stages. And so, imperceptibly, via work parties, the former concept of the special purpose camp, totally isolated on its islands, dissolved, and the archipelago, born and come to maturity on Solovki, began its malignant advance through the nation. A problem arose. The territory of this country had to be spread out in front of the archipelago, but without allowing the archipelago to conquer it, to distract it, to take it over, or assimilate it to itself. Every little island and every little hillock of the archipelago had to be encircled by a hostile, stormy Soviet seascape. It was permissible for the two worlds to interlock in separate strata, but not to intermingle. And this Nogtev report, which evoked a whisper of astonishment, was, after all, articulated so as to initiate a resolution by the workers of Chem, which would then appear in the newspapers and be posted in the villages. The intensifying class struggle inside the USSR and the danger of war which is increasing as never before. In our country, things are always increasing or intensifying as never before. They never, ever get weaker. Require of the organs of the OGPU and USLON even greater solidarity with the workers. Vigilance. By organization of public opinion, a struggle is to be waged against free persons rubbing elbows with prisoners, against concealment of escapees, against purchase of stolen and government property from prisoners, and against all kinds of malicious rumors which are being disseminated by class enemies about USLON. And just what were those malicious rumors? That people were imprisoned in camp and without cause? And one more point. It is the duty of every person to inform. Disgusting free people. They were making friends with Zeks. They were concealing escapees. This was a terrible danger. If an end was not put to it, there would be no archipelago, and the country would be a goner, and the revolution would be a goner. And therefore, to combat malicious rumors, honest progressive rumors were spread, that the camps were populated by murderers and rapists, that every escapee was a dangerous bandit. Lock your doors, be frightened, save your children, catch them, turn them in, help the work of the OGPU, and if you knew of someone who did not help thus, inform. Now, with the spread of the archipelago, escapes multiplied. There was the hopelessness of the logging and road-building work parties, yet at the same time there was a whole continent beneath the feet of the escapees. So there was hope in spite of all. However, escape plans had excited the Solovki prisoners even at a time when SLON was still on a totally isolated island. The innocents believed in the end of their 3-year term. But those who were foresighted had already grasped the truth, that they would never see freedom in either 3 or 23 years, and that meant freedom lay only in escape. But how could they escape from Solovki? For a half a year the sea was frozen over, but not solidly, and in places there was open water, and the snowstorms raged and the frost bit hard, and things were enveloped in mists and darkness. And in the spring, and for a large part of the summer, there were the long white nights with clear visibility over long distances for the patrolling cutters. And it was only when the nights began to lengthen in the late summer and the autumn that the time was right. Not for prisoners in the Kremlin, of course, but for those who were out in work parties where a prisoner might have freedom of movement and time to build a boat or a raft near the shore and to cast off at night, even just riding off on a log for that matter, and strike out at random, hoping above all to encounter a foreign ship. The bustle among the guards and the embarkation of the cutters would reveal to the islanders the fact of an escape, and there would be a tremor of rejoicing among the prisoners, as if they were themselves escaping. They would ask in a whisper, "Had he been caught yet? Had he been found yet?" Many must have drowned without ever getting anywhere. One or another of them reached the Karelian shore, perhaps, and if he did, was more silent than the grave. And there was a famous escape from Chem to England. This particular daredevil, his name is unknown to us, that's the breadth of our horizon, knew English and concealed it. He managed to get assigned to loading timber in Cam, and he's told his story to the Englishmen. The convoy discovered he was missing and delayed the ship for nearly a whole week and searched it several times without finding the fugitive. What happened was that whenever a search party started from the shore, they lowered him overboard on the opposite side on the anchor chain, where he clung underwater with a breathing pipe held in his teeth. An enormous fine had to be paid for delaying the ship, so they finally decided to take a chance and let the ship go, thinking that perhaps the prisoner had drowned. Then a book came out in England, even it would seem, in more than one printing. Evidently, An Island Hell by S.A. Malsagoff. And is this another book you have not read, Sir Bertrand Russell? This book astounded Europe, and no doubt they accused its fugitive author of exaggerating, for after all, the friends of the new society could not permit themselves to believe this slanderous volume. Because it contradicted what was already well known, the newspaper Rote Fahne had described Solovki as a paradise, and we hope that the paper's correspondent spent time in the archipelago later on. And it also contradicted those albums about Solovki disseminated by Soviet diplomatic missions in Europe. Fine quality paper and true-to-life photographs of the cozy monk's cells. Nadezhda Surovetsova, our communist in Austria, received this album from the Soviet mission in Vienna and indignantly denounced the slander about Solovki current in Europe. And at the very same time, the sister of her future husband was in fact imprisoned at Solovki, and she herself was predestined to be walking single file in the Yaroslavl isolator in 2 years' time. Slander or not, the breach had been a misfortune. And so a commission of VTSIK, under the chairmanship of the conscience of the party, Comrade Solz, was sent off to find out what was going on there on those Solovetsky Islands, for of course they didn't have the least idea. But in fact, the commission merely rode along the Murmansk Railroad, and they didn't do much of anything even there. And they thought it right to send to the islands, no, to implore to go there, none less than the great proletarian writer Maxim Gorky, who had recently returned to live in the proletarian fatherland. His testimony would be the very best refutation of that repulsive foreign forgery. The rumour reached Solovki before Gorky himself, and the prisoners' hearts beat faster, and the guards hustled and bustled. One has to know prisoners in order to imagine their anticipation. The Falcon, the Stormy Petrel, was about to swoop down upon the nest of injustice, violence, and secrecy. The leading Russian writer, he will give them hell. He will show them. He, the father, will defend. They awaited Gorky almost like a universal amnesty. The chiefs were alarmed, too. As best they could, they hid the monstrosities and polished things up for show. Transports of prisoners were sent from the Kremlin to distant work parties so that fewer would remain there. Many patients were discharged from the medical section, and the whole thing was cleaned up. And they set up a boulevard of fir trees without roots, which were simply pushed down into the ground. They only had to last a few days before withering. It led to the children's colony, opened just 3 months previously, and the pride of USLON, where everyone had clothes, and where there were no socially hostile children, and where, of course, Gorky would be very interested in seeing how juveniles were being re-educated and saved for a future life under socialism. Only in Kem was there an oversight. On Popov Island, the ship Gleb Boki was being loaded by prisoners in underwear and sacks, when Gorky's retinue appeared out of nowhere to embark on that steamer. You inventors and thinkers, here is a worthy problem for you, given that, as the saying goes, every wise man has enough of the fool in him. A barren island, not one bush, no possible cover, and right there, at a distance of 300 yards, Gorky's retinue has shown up. Your solution? Where can this disgraceful spectacle, these men dressed in sacks, be hidden? The entire journey of the great humanist will have been for naught if he sees them now. Well, of course, he will try hard not to notice them, but help him. Drown them in the sea. They will wallow and flounder. Bury them in the earth. There's no time. No, only a worthy son of the archipelago could find a way out of this one. The worker signer ordered, "Stop work! Close ranks! Still closer! Sit down on the ground! Sit still!" And a tarpaulin was thrown over them. "Anyone who moves will be shot!" And the former stevedore, Maxim Gorky, ascended the ship's ladder and admired the landscape from the steamer for a full hour till sailing time. And he didn't notice. That was June the 20th, 1929. The famous writer disembarked from the steamer in Prosperity Gulf. Next to him was his fiancée, all dressed in leather. A black leather service cap, a leather jacket, leather riding breeches and high, narrow boots, a living symbol of the Ogpu shoulder to shoulder with Russian literature. Surrounded by the commanding officer corps of the GPU, Gorky marched with long, swift strides through the corridors of several barracks. The room doors were all wide open, but he entered hardly any. In the medical section, doctors and nurses in clean robes formed up for him in two rows, but he didn't even look around and went on out. From there, the Chekists of Uzlon fearlessly took him to Serkirka, and what was there to see there? It turned out that there was no overcrowding in the punishment cells and, the main point, no poles, none at all. Thieves sat on benches. There was already a multitude of thieves in Solovki, and they were all reading newspapers. None of them were so bold as to get up and complain, but they did think up one trick. They held the newspapers upside down, and Gorky went up to one of them and in silence turned the newspaper right side up. He had noticed it. He had understood. He would not abandon them. He would defend them. The Gaipai Ushnitsa, the GPU woman agent, who was Gorky's companion, also exercised her pen, and here is what she wrote. We are getting to know the life of the Solovetsky camp. I went to the museum. All of us went to Sekir Hill. From there, it was a wonderful view of the lake. The water in the lake was coldly dark blue in color, and around the lake was a forest. It seemed to be bewitched, and as the light shifted, the tops of the pines flared up, and the mirror-like lake became fiery. Silence and astonishing beauty. On the way back, we passed the peat workings. In the evening, we listened to a concert. We dined on local Solovetsky herring, small but surprisingly tender and tasty. They melted in the mouth. From M. Gorky and Son, Moscow, Nauka, 1971, page 276. They went to the children's colony. How decent everything was there. Each was on a separate cot with a mattress. They all crowded around in a group and all of them were happy. And all of a sudden a 14-year-old boy said, Listen here, Gorky, everything you see here is false. Do you want to know the truth? Shall I tell you? Yes, nodded the writer. Yes, he wanted to know the truth. Oh, you bad boy, why do you want to spoil the just recently arranged prosperity of the literary patriarch? A palace in Moscow, an estate outside Moscow. And so everyone was ordered to leave, including the children and the accompanying Guy Pyushnitsky, and the boy spent an hour and a half telling the whole story to the lanky old man. Gorky left the barracks streaming tears. He was given a carriage to go to dinner at the villa of the camp chief, and the boys rushed back into the barracks. Did you tell him about the mosquito treatment? Yes. Did you tell him about the pole torture? Yes. Did you tell him about the prisoners hitched up instead of horses? Yes. And how they roll them down the stairs, and about the sacks, and about being made to spend the night in the snow? And it turned out that the truth-loving boy had told all. But we don't even know his name. On June the 22nd, in other words, after his chat with the boy, Gorky left the following inscription in the visitor's book, which had been specially made for this visit. I am not in a state of mind to express my impressions in just a few words. I wouldn't want, yes, and I would likewise be ashamed, to permit myself banal praise of the remarkable energy of people who, while remaining vigilant and tireless sentinels of the revolution, are able, at the same time, to be remarkably bold creators of culture. This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.